This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on the program, President Obama takes executive action on immigration, paving the way for millions of people to obtain temporary legal status. Officials in India are investigating why a sterilization drive resulted in the deaths of 15 women and the hospitalization of dozens more. And parents of 43 still missing students in Mexico caravan across country and continue their call for their son's safe return. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. President Barack Obama announced he will take executive action, allowing about 5 million undocumented immigrants in the United States to obtain temporary legal status. The president made the major immigration policy announcement Thursday night in a 15-minute speech, but it was not televised on any major U.S. network. Obama said he chose to take executive action because Republican leaders in the House have refused to allow a vote on bipartisan immigration reform legislation for a year and a half now. The new measure is similar to the Deferred Action Program that many so-called Dreamers, or immigrants brought to the U.S. as minors, are eligible for. The president explained who will now qualify under the action.
If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows and get right with the law. That's what this deal is.
The announcement comes after years of record-high deportations and pressure from immigrant rights advocates. Across the country, immigrant advocacy organizations held watch parties during the speech. Here are some reactions to the president's announcement from attendees at one such event, hosted by Casa de Maryland in Hyattsville, a suburb of Washington, D.C.
Ha sido de esta manera durante décadas. Y durante décadas hemos hecho mucho al respecto. Cuando yo tomé el cargo, yo comencé.
Marcela Campos, from Silver Spring. It's a great opportunity for all the people that we have, children that are USA citizens or residents. We can get out from the shadows. We can feel free. We can do more for the community now that we're going to have a legal status in the country. I'm undocumented and I have my son here, so anytime that I going out, I'm afraid to be deported and afraid to get by the police and they report to immigration about my status.
Gustavo Andrade, title is Organizing Director at CASA. So we're incredibly happy this evening. There's a lot of joy in my heart and the hearts of, I know, millions of people tonight. Because the speech is really a validation of many, many people's efforts over many years. I'm thinking of all of those who marched and organized and risked and sacrificed to make this happen. He said no for 6 years, but after 6 years, tonight he said yes.
Dilma Serrano, en D.C., Washington, D.C., pues la verdad, hay una emoción muy grande.
So I'm very happy, first of all, that this happened. I'm very happy. It's such an important step. It's going to mean a lot of benefit to the community. But I also feel for those who didn't qualify. I can think of people maybe who came when they were 17 and have been working very hard since they've been here. But for those people, for everybody else, you know, this is something that we are going to keep fighting for. So we need to come together. We need to rise up and continue fighting. This is not over. So I'm very happy I qualified. And, you know, I believe in President Obama. And we still have hope. And we still have faith in President Obama that he will continue to do the right thing. I think he can do something for everybody else. He has a heart. He can continue and continue to open doors for us. That is my hope.
Ricardo Campos, Silver Spring, Maryland. The president's speech was great. I think that this is just a step forward. Obviously, there's a couple of millions that will benefit from this, but there's so much more to do. Many of our parents will not benefit from this action. But I feel really grateful. My sister will be able to qualify for a work permit, and she will be able to be here with her baby. We will be able to wake up every morning without the fear of knowing that my sister could be deported, and I will end up here with the baby, with my nephew. And just thinking about that we can be separated is terrifying. And tomorrow we can wake up and smile and know that I can drive to work, and that my sister will stay home with her baby, and that she won't be separated, that I will go back home and I will see them there. I will go back home and she will still be there with her baby without fearing separation and deportation.
Earlier this week, the U.S. Senate failed, by a one-vote margin, to pass legislation that would have approved construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. The dramatic vote, which came just days after the House voted to approve the controversial project, means the issue is now dead for the remainder of the session. But as Ashley Westerman reports from Washington, D.C., Republicans intend to bring it up early in the next Congress.
Leslie Joyce Abrams of Georgia.
Just moments after the results of the vote count on the Keystone XL pipeline approval bill was announced, a Native American victory song filled the Senate chamber. C-SPAN captured the moment. Red Gray Cloud of the Lakota Nation continued to sing as Capitol Hill security escorted him out of the building in handcuffs. Tribes of the Lakota Nation are adamantly and openly opposed to the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline on their lands. The pipeline would carry more than 800,000 barrels of tar sands oil a day from Alberta, Canada to U.S. Gulf Coast refineries, spanning 1,200 miles, crossing 9 states, including South Dakota. But earlier Tuesday morning, in kicking off 6 hours of debate on the legislation, one of the bill's co-sponsors, Louisiana Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu, said the U.S. already has 2.6 million miles of pipeline, and that the new pipeline would only add about 1,000 miles more.
What is everybody upset about? We've been building pipelines in this country for a long, long time, and we need to build this one. This is about energy independence. It's about jobs. That's why I'm here. This is what the people want.
Landrieu, chairwoman of the Senate Energy Committee, started a political firestorm last week when she urged her Senate colleagues to take up the bill. She is locked in a tight race to keep her Senate seat in Louisiana, which is dependent on the energy sector. But her efforts may have been in vain, as her Republican challenger, Representative Bill Cassidy, quickly sponsored the Keystone XL pipeline approval bill that successfully passed Friday in the House. But environmental advocates say there is much to be upset about, as the XL portion of the pipeline would catalyze the market for the most carbon-intensive oil on the planet, with devastating results to the climate. Louisa Abbott-Galveo, climate and energy associate with Friends of the Earth, says the difference between tar sands oil and regular crude oil is the extraction process. Unlike regular oil that is pumped out of the ground, she says tar sands is a combination of sand, clay, water, and bitumen, which is extracted as an unconventional source of oil.
It has the consistency of peanut butter, so it has to be virtually baked out of the ground in order that the bitumen be separated from the rest of the mix. And this is an incredibly energy-intensive extraction and refining process, which results in the emission of 3 times more greenhouse gases than conventional gasoline.
While a State Department report released in January found that the project would very likely not have a significant effect on greenhouse gas emissions, opponents dispute those findings. Melinda Pierce, legislative director of the Sierra Club, says the assessment failed to look at the whole picture and noted the evaluation is still ongoing. Further, she says the State Department is being held up because of litigation in Nebraska about the route of the pipeline, a decision that is supposed to be ruled on in the coming months.
So any move by Congress to try and preempt the decision when much remains to be followed through would be injurious.
For 6 years, President Obama has also maintained this wait-and-see approach for the pipeline. He's repeatedly said he'd prefer to wait until the full State Department evaluation is complete. Even if the bill did pass both chambers of Congress this week, he was still expected to veto the project. But proponents of the pipeline say the project has been delayed long enough. Florida Petroleum Council Executive Director David Mica says he doesn't see the Keystone XL pipeline as an environmental or transportation issue, only that it will move the U.S. towards energy independence and create thousands of much-needed jobs. He says if the Canadians are going to produce the oil anyway, the U.S. should benefit.
And it's going to be brought to market one way or another. So bringing it to American refineries makes a great deal of sense in the sense that we can have those American jobs at the refineries, those American jobs in the construction of the pipeline, and in securing that product for our nation's energy future.
The State Department says that while the 2-year construction phase of the Keystone XL pipeline is projected to create about 2,000 jobs, TransCanada estimates that once finished, only about 50 new American jobs will be needed for the operational phase. In reaction to the bill's defeat Tuesday in the Senate, incoming Senate Majority Leader Kentucky Republican Mitch McConnell told the press the Keystone XL pipeline will be on the agenda early in the next Congress and that he is confident it will succeed. But environmental advocates are also moving forward and say momentum is gaining in the fight against any expansion of carbon-based energy infrastructure in the country in order to achieve energy independence through clean sources like wind and solar. Louisa Abbott Galveo of Friends of the Earth.
So this movement is increasing, it's mobilizing, and it's organized, and we're going to keep fighting every new fossil fuel project.
Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The U.S. Senate also failed to advance the USA Freedom Act this week, coming 2 votes shy of forcing a vote on the measure that would have curtailed the NSA's bulk collection of telephone records. The bill was originally introduced to reform the NSA's Dragnet surveillance program, but was watered down considerably in the House. The NSA's broad surveillance powers remain in place for now. Congress is expected to take up the issue again before June, when the relevant sections of the Patriot Act expire. FSRN is independent media, supported by listeners like you. For more information about how to keep us on the air, please visit our website at fsrn.org. People across Mexico mark the anniversary of the country's revolution this week by demonstrating in solidarity with the parents of 43 missing students from the Ayotzinapa Teachers College. The parents spent much of the week traveling around the country to shore up public support for their demand that the state find and return their abducted sons. The federal government's investigation seems to rest on detainee statements that all of the students were killed by members of a drug gang shortly after police from the city of Iguala took them into custody. The parents continue to hold out hope their sons are alive and refuse to accept any theory without physical evidence to back it up. The parents split up into 3 groups to canvass the country and converged in Mexico City Thursday evening to lead the largest protest yet, calling for justice in the case. Shannon Young reports.
The journey by parents and classmates of the missing students brought out supporters in each city and town they stopped in along the way. One caravan went north, another south, and a third traveled around Guerrero, the state in which the Ayotzinapa Teachers College is located and the epicenter of ongoing protests. The 3 groups converged in Mexico City on Thursday, November 20th, the 104th anniversary of the start of the Mexican Revolution.
El motivo de nuestra venida, señores, es...
Carmelita Mendoza, mother of Jorge Cruz Mendoza, explained that the parents embarked on the nationwide caravans to rally support and pressure the government to find and return their sons. The families hold the state accountable for their son's fate because the students vanished after they were taken into custody by uniformed police in the city of Iguala the night of September 26th. The local mayor allegedly ordered their disappearance. The Attorney General announced earlier this month that 3 detainees gave statements indicating that all 43 students were handed over to criminals and killed the same night they disappeared. According to the official line, those who carried out the murders also incinerated the remains. Without physical evidence, the parents don't accept the story and demand the search remain active. Valentin Cornelio is one of the parents.
They want to take the case in another direction and end this struggle. But for us, this struggle is just getting started. If our boys don't turn up, we're not going to go away. They took them away alive and therefore are responsible for 43 lives.
The case of the missing students has resonated in a country where tens of thousands of people have gone missing in the last 7 years. Authorities have long blamed organized crime for the large-scale abductions, yet relatives who carry out their own investigations say they encounter little support from government institutions when it comes to searching for their loved ones. During the caravan stop in Oaxaca, Elizabeth, an accounting student who gave only her first name, stood with her young daughter on the sidelines of a large march holding a homemade sign.
If we don't fight today, we'll be under the government's yoke tomorrow. The authorities don't want to accept that it was the state who disappeared the students, and that's who has to return them. And this isn't just about the mayor. This involves all three levels of government. News of the situation was known. Why didn't they take immediate action? Why did they wait so long to react and uncover what all was happening? Now they're looking for them dead, in graves, in garbage dumps. They're telling us that they were incinerated, whereas in social media, it's being said that it rained so hard that night, a fire like that would have been impossible.
The situation has become a political crisis for President Enrique Peña Nieto. Federal officials have tried to deflect criticism about their foot dragging, saying the crime occurred within the jurisdictional boundaries of the state of Guerrero. Peña Nieto took 9 days to even address the disappearances and left the country for a week just after Mexico's attorney general announced the students were likely massacred soon after their abduction by police. On Tuesday, in his first public appearance since returning from economic and trade summits abroad, Peña Nieto lashed out at those who use violence to destabilize Mexico. But he wasn't referring to organized crime or corrupt politicians and police, but rather to protesters.
It seems as if they're acting on behalf of interests to destabilize or create social unrest, and most of all, target the national agenda we've been promoting. The federal government stands firm and is determined to continue working towards a national agenda to bring well-being to more Mexicans and to accelerate the rate of economic development and growth, which we want for all Mexicans. We will not stop.
Demonstrations in solidarity with the Ayotzinapa Teachers College have brought tens of thousands of people into the streets, especially in Mexico City. Some protesters have started fires and broken windows in government buildings and offices of political parties. Omar Garcia, an Ayotzinapa student and survivor of the September 26th police attack, says there's a clear bias when it comes to the official discourse and definition of violence.
When they call us and those who accompany us violent, they start to take sides because they condemn us, but not those who have taken thousands off to mass graves. They say we're violent when we're blocking a road, but they don't say anything about roadblocks manned by hired killers. They stay real quiet about that. Let's leave these contradictions by the wayside and take a stand once and for all, because this country has to change. And if it doesn't change, then it should at least be clear that those of us from Ayotzinapa, as students and parents, are doing everything possible to shake up this country's establishment.
The movement around the case of the missing students is rapidly becoming the most organized and cohesive challenge to President Peña Nieto's administration. The question on the minds of many Mexicans now is whether the ruling party will respond with the same authoritarian tactics of its not-so-distant past. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
In Turkey, the government has revived plans to demolish Istanbul's Gezi Park, the flashpoint for last year's anti-government protests that left at least 8 people dead and 8,000 injured across the country. City officials say the public will have a chance to vote on the project, but heavy machinery at the park this week indicated otherwise. Jacob Resnick reports.
In early hours of Wednesday morning, bulldozers began digging on the fringe of Gezi Park on Istanbul's Taksim Square. Scores of protesters turned up to stop the work and fill in the trench with their bare hands, as shown on a brief video clip posted online by Twitter user Ertürk Erkek.
People went there, and I mean, it was so emotional in a way. People are so sensitive about this place after all these losses and all the struggle. I think people will continue to protect that area.
That's Murat Cedin of the Chamber of Architects and Engineers, which has criticized the plan to raise one of the city center's last green spaces and replace it with a shopping mall. Earlier this week, the municipality reinserted the controversial plan in its 2015 budget request. Wednesday's excavation was officially to enlarge a city bus stop, but Metin says the late-night timing makes it suspicious.
Everybody interprets this as an attempt to test the ground. We're waiting some more days to struggle with the government and to protect this public space for the public.
By Wednesday afternoon, the grass had been replaced by municipal crews. In Turkey, Gezi Park has become a symbol for resistance against perceived authoritarianism of Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who this year confounded critics by moving into a $615 million palace built over a protected forest in the capital Ankara. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
You're listening to the weekly edition of Free Speech Radio News, listener-funded grassroots news. Find out more at fsrn.org. In India, more than 15 women died and scores of others fell seriously ill following a botched sterilization drive in a central state this month. Now, authorities are investigating a possible link between the deaths and substandard and contaminated drugs. The tragedy has raised serious questions about India's approach to population control and its public health care system. Bismila Gilani has the story.
At the district hospital in Bilaspur, in the central Indian state of Chhattisgarh, Tribani Devi is desperately trying to bottle feed her 18-month-old grandson. But the baby refuses to feed and cries incessantly. The baby's mother, Hemlata, lies unconscious in a bed, fighting for her life.
I don't understand what they did and how it all happened, but look how tragic it is. This child is so hungry. He wants his mother to feed him, and she is in this state, almost dead. I'm so worried. I don't know what to do.
Hemlata is among the 83 women who underwent a sterilization operation at a government-run free medical camp last week. Soon after the tubal ligation surgery, she complained of severe abdominal pain and vomiting. She was rushed to the hospital, where she remains in critical condition, along with 50 other women. 15 women, all in their early 30s, have died so far. 35-year-old school teacher Rakesh Kumar curses the moment he allowed his late wife to participate in the camp.
The doctors treated them like animals. They did the surgery within a few minutes and dumped them back into their homes without any post-surgery care.
The deaths have sent shockwaves across the country, sparking massive protests in several cities. Under public pressure, the local government has initiated action against several officials accused of negligence, in addition to ordering a judicial inquiry into the matter. Authorities say they suspect contaminated drugs given to the women after surgery may have caused the complications and deaths. But many put the main blame on the conduct of the healthcare professionals performing more than 80 tubectomies in just 6 hours using the same surgical instruments. Puneet Bedi is a gynecologist based in Delhi.
After all, it's a surgical procedure, just like appendix removal or gallbladder removal. How can you do it in a tent under a tree? The time needed just to wash hands between two procedures is 3 to 5 minutes. Then you have to change and sterilize the equipment, and that takes minimum 2 hours, so obviously they use contaminated equipment for multiple surgeries, which is completely wrong and unacceptable medically, legally, and ethically. But unfortunately, this has been going on over and over again, and nobody cares. Nobody ever raises a question.
The doctors performing the surgeries say they were under pressure to achieve the target of 80 surgeries per shift the administration had set for them. Nearly 5 million people are sterilized in India every year. More than 70% of them are women. Activists say a majority of the operations are performed without the informed consent of the patient. Deepa Sinha is Program Manager of Public Health and Nutrition at the New Delhi-based Center for Equity Studies.
Among the various methods of contraception, female sterilization is the one with most side effects and involves many risks, and yet this remains our main focus. We are just obsessed with this. It has become another way of systemic oppression of women. The government campaign plays on the existing gender inequality in the society and stresses on female sterilization in a way as if this is the only way and there is no other choice. The idea of informed consent is not even heard of.
With more than 1.2 billion residents, India is currently the world's second most populous country. According to United Nations estimates, the country will surpass neighboring China as the most populous nation in less than 2 decades. India introduced its first family planning program in the 1950s. Its aim was to raise awareness about various methods of contraception. In the 1970s, the government tried a more aggressive birth control policy focused on male sterilization, but it met a stiff public and political resistance. The government launched another family planning program based on targets and incentives for families practicing a two-child norm in the 1990s. It was also criticized on the ground that it influences behaviors in a way that hinders informed choice. The government claims that it has since abandoned both the setting of targets and offering incentives, making the program completely voluntary. But Sinha from the Institute of Equity Studies disagrees.
It's changed only on paper. In practice, it's the same. In fact, it now has an element of coercion because both incentives and disincentives are now at work. So the couples will be told that if you sterilize after 2 children, you will get this much money and such other benefits. But if you don't, then you would be deprived of such and such development scheme running in your area, and you won't be able to stand for a local body election, etc. And this is internationally known to be a flawed approach.
Sinha blames this policy for what she describes as the public health disasters, like the one that happened at Chhattisgarh. She insists that much more can be achieved by shifting focus to reducing infant mortality and providing people access to better health facilities and alternative contraceptive methods. The sterilization deaths in Chhattisgarh have brought the issue of population control to national focus, and calls for a complete rethink of the current policy are growing louder. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. You'll find more information online at fsrn.org. Technical support this week was provided by Lewis Reining at WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Music used in today's program is by Rob Coslow via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.